to the Honorable Jane Magnus Stenson from the United States District Court for the Southern District of Indiana, who has agreed to sit with us today and help us on these cases. Welcome.
Thank you, Judge.
So we'll start with the first case of the day, Tucker versus Williams, 10-2835. For the appellant, Mr. Stiegel.
Thank you, Judge Tender. Your Honors, Kendall Tucker, at the time of these events, were 2007, was a career school teacher living in Canton, which is the county south of Peoria. He was originally from Downers Grove, a retired coach or administrator from his school retired to Canton area. There's a lake and there's a lot of hunting around there for those who do it. It's borders the Illinois River. And he met an old high school friend and said, well, why don't we go into the landscaping business? And there was business there. There's this Lake Wematuck that's got boating on it, and people were in need of that. And as I've learned, I'm not a duck hunter, but people do use backhoes to dig their blinds. And so we said, I've got this case backhoe. Tucker, this occurred in 2000. We have a cashier's check in the record that Tucker got to pay his $10,000 half. Ray got the backhoe. Tucker went about using the backhoe without incident for a number of years. Like many in these times, Tucker had a problem with a brother-in-law his sister had married badly and had a drug problem, and he tried to help his sister and eventually was estranged.
Fortunately, the federal government has no interest in the outcome of domestic relation problems. It's left to the state. The federals have no interest in the outcome of domestic relation problems. But
yes.
It's interesting as a sidelight.
Yes, at any rate, the drug-dealing brother-in-law eventually gets caught up with this task force and was giving tips after he was cooperating. That's how it leads to Kendall Tucker. Carl Williams, the defendant, it's an unusual case in that he knew him for 15 to 17 years. It's a small county and town. They'd hunted together. Their children were in school together.
What is the population of Fulton County, by the way?
I would say Fulton County, I wouldn't be more than 60, 70,000. Canton's 20,000. Lewiston Spoon River Anthology is about 2 or 5,000. So that's about it. And then there's a lot of strip mines abandoned. It's great hunting grounds for people who want that. And that lake there is a nice place. So that was why the backhoe was being used. And there's a lot of activity down there about this time of year. So they do a consent search of Williams does a consent search for drugs of Tucker's house. He has no drugs. I mean, he's had a lung transplant for one condition, and may have to have a liver transplant for some congenital condition. So his health is bad enough, and there is. No drugs found. Williams himself says he doesn't believe Tucker's dealing drugs. The tip was also that the backhoe's stolen. Well, I don't know. Our two of you from down in the Southern District of Indiana may have been near rural areas. I know I am. Farm equipment, construction equipment aren't registered. You don't get a certificate of title with the Secretary of State. People buy them and they leave them out there. And so the backhoe doesn't have a certificate of title.
But there's still ownership.
Yeah, of course. We go back to the basic common law years ago, before all that. And there's a question.
And there's concern about the ownership of that vehicle. And Officer Williams says, we got these problems. And your guy, Mr. Tucker, says, well, look, if it's stolen, take it.
And on June 22nd, he said that. There's a factual dispute.
Right. And did he ever withdraw that?
Well, that's the question on August 10th. But I would also ask you on the content to cut to the case, Judge, is can you consent to give up something when there's no lawful authority to take it? And here's the key factor in that, and I'll get to the procedural due process, which is, I think, the most significant part of this, is the only offense I could find is receiving stolen property. I think it was a common law crime that's part of the Illinois theft statute. Well, that requires knowledge, and Williams said that he never thought Tucker knew this was stolen, so how in the world do you have authority to seize it?
Well, it's not a matter of proof. It's probable cause, right?
Well, but you have to have a crime. You have to have some reason to believe there's a crime.
And yeah, you have to have some reason to believe there's a crime. You don't have to have a crime.
Well, except that Williams says he didn't believe Tucker knew the backhoe was stolen, so he's a bona fide purchaser.
Well, that's because he likes him. He doesn't want
Well, okay, but, you know, it's awful thin.
But doesn't he have reason to believe there was a crime in that the backhoe was stolen? Not necessarily that your client committed it, but that a crime occurred because the backhoe was stolen.
Well, that may be, but if he's a bona fide purchaser, there's no grounds to seize
it. That is one you hash out when you're retrieving what is apparently stolen property.
Well, what authority? Nobody's ever given me the authority to do that.
Sure he did. What? Your client gave him authority to take it if he thought it was stolen.
Well, if you believe that disputed fact, but I'd also ask you...
I didn't know that was in dispute.
Yeah, I gave you in the brief where he said the second time when he came back, he said, I said that the first time, not the second time.
The first time is enough.
Well, but...
He doesn't have to keep saying it over and over. He says it the first time.
So does that content my... argument, but I think that's, I want to get to the procedural due process. Consent does not last for perpetuity.
Go to the procedural due process then.
Yeah, let's do it. These are interesting issues, but he seized it. Okay.
And your client had agreed to keep it on the property there, hadn't he? Didn't he say, the officer say, well, just don't move it anywhere?
Well, he might have said that. I don't know the authority for that. Of course, a significant breach is the neighbors right next door, right down the road, and he let him use it. He certainly didn't have any authority to tell him not to use it. And so then that's when he seizes it when it's at the neighbors, and then he gets into this inquiry with who Williams determines is the actual owner of the property. Illinois Contractor Materials, ICMC, they got 63 backhoes, and they don't know they're the owner. Judge Mim found significant that Tucker didn't have a bill of sale. ICMC didn't have a bill of sale. And, in fact, we waived hearsay objections, but the gal in charge of their inventory had to go to a leasing agent to find out anything about this. So that leaves the warranty. Well, there was a warranty registered to ICMC, but, of course, the warranty is always registered to the first purchaser. When you buy a used vehicle, the warranty, you won't get the warranty. Usually it's either expired, and depending on the terms, sometimes the sale terminates it. So, interestingly enough, Illinois has a statute providing for notice and hearing when you seize property with an arrest warrant. But there's no such statute without, unusually so. So that puts us within Zimmerman versus Birch, at the established state procedure of Illinois, absent such a statute. In Zimmerman versus Birch, the Supreme Court case, Florida didn't have a statute addressing requiring physicians to determine if a patient was competent to make the voluntary commitment to mental health confinement. And they said, well, yes, that's established state procedure. So we get down to the arguments I've seen below and here has been that, well, that's all right, there's a state tort remedy. Well, there is no case that holds when a hearing is practicable that a state tort remedy is adequate. Now, a hearing's certainly practicable here. Now, we got with Judge Mim into a difference of whether it's pre-deprivation or post-deprivation. I grant you the Fourth Amendment allowed the seizure initially. But that doesn't mean that ultimately property does not have to be determined who's the owner at a hearing. And it seems to be in the Tenth Circuit this has came up most of the time. I had three cases from there after criminal trials. Well, is it his or isn't it? And then there was one federal case where possession of firearms, and he was convicted. But the question was, well, okay, even if he's convicted of the crime of possession of these counterband firearms, well, does he still have some sort of ownership there? You got to give a hearing. Wasn't done. And, you know, if There's also questions of notice. I mean, Judge Mims said, well, the friend told him it was seized, but the state has to give notice more than just, we've got your property. Fuentes versus Shevin is a classic case. Mrs. Fuentes certainly knew they seized her refrigerator, but procedural due process required notice of the opportunity for hearing. My friend, defending Williams, mentions the West Covina case, but that, I submit to you, answers what sort of process was due. My gosh, they said your property's been seized. Here's why. Here's who to contact about to get it back or to find out what happens. The plaintiff went to the judge, called the judge, and the judge was identified. He was on vacation. He didn't follow through, and the Supreme Court said, well, he had notice and opportunity to be heard. Well, here, Tucker never had any notice of really what was going on. And I submit to you this is fairly significant because, you know, when people are less than eager, when the police are investigating them for drug crimes, to go out and make waves with the police, and there's just no law that we'd upend the procedural due process, we might as well totally destroy the concept of notice and hearing. If we sustain the position here as well, you might be able to sue him for conversion or something else. And I would add that I guess it's not controlling, but ironically, Judge Mims said, well, you don't have a cause of action for conversion. So, you know, what are you left with? The second part of this is part of the appeal, and it's very brief, is the 11th Amendment argument. Basically, Illinois has set this up constitutionally. You can have intergovernmental agreements. There's a statute on it. It's in Part 5 of the Code of Government where counties, in this case counties, there might have been a city involved, can agree with the state. And it doesn't say anything about what those are defined, but the Local Governmental Tort Immunity Act defines them as local public entities. And, in fact, a bi-state agreement between the state of Missouri and the state of Illinois down in the East St. Louis area for highways was held to be a local public entity by the Illinois Supreme Court. That's what the statute says. Granted,
doesn't the statute also exclude, though, specifically state actors from the definition?
No. No, I don't think it does. The whole premise of the Tort Immunity Act in Illinois, Judge, is ultimately they pay compensations under Section 9-102.
Oh, I was referring to the Local Government Cooperation Act or whatever the exact title is.
The one that created the task force.
Right.
There is a provision there about what to do on purchasing, and that may be there, but the specific statute says what type of entity is this, if local public entity. So, unless there are questions.
Yeah, I do have a question.
Sure.
The Maltby case that Judge Mim talked a great deal about, I don't recall seeing you discuss that in your brief. Maltby versus Winston from our circuit?
To be honest with you, Judge, I'm going to tell you, I'll just look at it and answer in rebuttal if it's permissible.
I'm sorry,
I'm drawing a blank on that case.
Fine.
I might also say as an observation, we have these case management techniques, but how we got this far on the 20,000 property, we never had the chance to the judge saying, what in the world's going on here? But it failed, so now we're here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you're going to have to help me on the pronunciation here, Mr. Huzag?
Richard Huzag.
Thank you.
Famous in DuPage County, but not here.
Well, I think that the family, the clan has spread beyond DuPage, and I don't know whether everybody else thinks that's a good thing or not, but good to be back here. Assistant Attorney General Richard Huzag, counsel for Defendant Carl Williams, and as a housekeeping matter, I have an agreement with the counsel for the co-appellee, Fulton County, that he would transfer to me 5 minutes of his time with the court's allowance so that I would have 15 instead of 10.
Sure, and you don't have to use all of it if you don't want.
Right. And if you have any questions about the 11th Amendment, I'll do my best, but that's not the nature of my representation here today. And I would urge the court both to affirm the district court's ruling on the merits of the Fourth Amendment and procedural due process issues, but significantly to reverse the district court's entry of the sanction of attorney's fees against Carl Williams for having sought leave to file a supplemental motion for summary judgment. The motion for leave to file was granted. The supplementary summary judgment motion was granted. But the district court judge saying that it was only fair because the briefing originally had been allegedly inadequate to require Mr. Williams to pay Mr. Tucker's counsel's attorney's fees to the tune of $3,000. And if I could address the fee issue first, because I think these are issues that often don't get a lot of attention, but in this case, I think it's important that the court focus on this and, in fact, conclude that there was an abuse of discretion for multiple reasons. This is not a Section 11 sanction. This was not a Section 19, Rule 11 sanction or a Section 1927 sanction. This was an exercise of the district court's inherent authority to punish bad faith conduct or willful disobedience with a court order or conduct tantamount to that level of misconduct. And there is no express finding, as the rules require and as this court's case law requires, of bad faith or its equivalent. And in fact, the finding that the judge made, inadequate briefing, is the type of thing that is unfortunately part of the normal course of litigation all the time. And I suggest that nothing would guarantee more satellite litigation over fees and more appeals over satellite litigation over fees than an opinion by this court affirming the notion that mere principles of fairness based upon inadequate briefing by one of the party's counsel is enough to create an exception to the American rule against fee shifting and support an award of attorney's fees so that one side must pay the other side's counsel.
Well, the problem, I think, from Judge Mims' perspective is that he devotes all these resources to getting the case moving, works on these summary judgment motions, does what he has to do to get those done, and then there's another. The schedule for briefing had been set, and
If a motion had been filed without leave of court in violation of the scheduling order for a supplemental motion for summary judgment, this would be a different case. Here, a motion was filed for leave to file a motion for supplemental summary judgment. That's just saying, can we depart from the schedule? There's one last legal issue in this case. It's the post-deprivation due process issue. You had indicated that we, as the defendants, had not identified the adequate state law remedies that could be followed. So we're going to go to trial on this purely legal issue. To avoid a trial, Defendant Williams' counsel, the trial attorney in this case, said, can we have leave to file a motion for summary judgment on that last remaining issue? It wasn't just a unilateral, here, Judge, you decided we should win. It's a request to depart from the court's schedule. And I understand the schedules are meant to be adhered to, and exceptions to those schedules shouldn't be granted for light grounds. But here, the attorney who sanctioned effectively, representing his counsel, said, okay, maybe the briefing could have been more complete on this one issue. And in fact, this aspect of the procedural due process claim didn't really become clear until the response to the initial motion for summary judgment, where Mr. Stiegel had said, oh, in the post-deprivation context, Peratt doesn't really apply here because, and the reply said, yes, it does, but didn't go on to spell out the state law procedures for plevin or conversion that would apply. Maybe that was an adequate briefing. But does that mean that every time there's a motion for reconsideration that's filed, or a motion for leave to file a motion for reconsideration that's filed, that warrants sanctions because better lawyering might have resulted in a more efficient handling and disposition of the case? I submit that this is a very narrow exception. The test is bad faith or willful disobedience of a court order. Neither of those have been alleged.
Rule 16F that opposing counsel refers to in his papers about failure to obey a court order? And I think you've acknowledged there was a scheduling order. How do you respond to that?
There was no violation. It was simply a request for leave to file a motion for supplemental summary judgment. So that's, the local rules and the federal rules permit that type of request to depart from a scheduling order. We didn't just violate the scheduling order. Again, that would be a different case. We asked for leave to file this. That motion for leave was granted, and then the supplemental summary judgment motion was itself granted. I think this is, perfectly omniscient lawyering, it's satisfactory lawyering. It's the type of lawyering that happens all the time. And if the court holds that that's enough based upon principles of fairness to justify a fee award in this case, I guarantee there are going to be a lot of fee petitions and a lot of fee appeals that are generated because somebody's going to say, oh, that's not fair. Their motion for summary judgment really should have been filed as a motion to dismiss, and now I've had to waste time on discovery. It's the same issue that could have been filed earlier. This motion for reconsideration is the type of thing that should have been brought up earlier. I want sanctions. That's not what this narrow exception to the American rule allows, based upon principles of efficiency and fairness. And so I would urge the court, for the reasons that we have submitted in our briefs, we didn't violate a court order. There's some suggestion that there was an obligation to provide notice to the other side, that there was an intent to seek leave to file the supplemental summary judgment motion. There's no such obligation. The rules don't provide that anywhere. That's sort of a fabrication out of, you know, in the brief by the other side. That's an exaggeration of something they said in the district court that itself isn't justified by any provision in the local rules. Let me turn then to the merits of the Fourth Amendment and due process issues. And I think the court has a pretty good grasp of the Fourth Amendment issues, so unless there are specific questions on the consent or on the probable cause aspects of it, or even on the qualified immunity aspect of it, I'd like to turn to the procedural due process issue here.
There's just one issue I'd like for you to address, if you would, please, and it's the opposing counsel's discussion of the omission of certain facts by Officer Williams when he sought counsel from the prosecutor. For example, I think they cite what Mr. Hyman had been involved in, as well as his knowledge of the bad blood between the two of them, and I want to address that issue.
Okay. If I could first situate that in the bigger picture.
Sure.
This is a very minor point. We are not relying exclusively or heavily upon the notion that the local state's attorney said, yes, you have legal authority to seize the backhoe without a warrant here based upon a finding of probable cause. We would argue that this court can conclude based upon all the other facts, including those, that there was probable cause. You can't sort of fly-spec this mosaic of facts and pull out one or two and say, oh, then the whole fabric unravels. There was enough here, plenty enough. You've got the report by the brother-in-law that says the backhoe's stolen. You've got the fishy circumstances surrounding its original purchase. You've got the later investigation with the company whose first response to the inquiry about it once the serial number was tracked back is, how the hell did it get to Fulton County? It disappeared off of one of their construction sites. And they had the warranty for it. They had documentary proof that they were the original owner. And backhoes don't just drive themselves away for 200 miles and disappear into the middle of the night. There was enough to establish probable cause here, independent of the state's attorney's separate determination of that based upon the facts presented. And the probable cause is, again, an alternative to the consent issue, which is that doesn't have an invisible ink shelf life on it. It extends unless it's explicitly revoked, and here I don't even think there's a genuine issue of fact about the second meeting between the plaintiff and defendant Williams, where there was again a similar comment to, if it's stolen, take it. That consent, in addition to the probable cause ground, is enough. So I think the state's attorney's issue and the facts provided the state's attorney were a fairly complete and representative presentation of the facts, but to the extent that you could quibble or nitpick a couple of those things, it doesn't depart from the basis for the ruling on the Fourth Amendment issue by Judge Mim in this case. So if I may, then I'd like to turn to the procedural due process issue. Even in the briefing below, the plaintiff recognizes that the Pratt rule is not the only application of the Matthews versus Eldridge test in which no pre-deprivation process is required. Because it's, you know, there are either exigent circumstances, there's adulterated food, or, you know, there's about to be a run on the bank. There are a number of situations in which no pre-deprivation process is required. And they concede that for Fourth Amendment finding of probable cause and a seizure pursuant to the Fourth Amendment that's valid dispenses with the need for any pre-seizure, pre-deprivation hearing. So the only issue here is the adequacy of the post-deprivation process. And all this discussion about we didn't meet the Pratt random and unauthorized standard is beside the point. That would be relevant only to determining whether there was a need for pre-deprivation process at all. The Fourth Amendment dispenses with that issue entirely. And as to the post-deprivation process, there is no meaningful issue with respect to the adequacy of notice of the seizure. Remember, He had defied his promise not to move the thing by letting his neighbor take it. It was taken from the neighbor. The neighbor refused to accept a receipt for it. The neighbor immediately telephoned Tucker and let him know that it had been seized. There's no doubt that there was notice that was effective, and if he's claiming that there was some formulaic or technical requirement that isn't complied with, there's no prejudice from it and therefore no due process issue. The only question then is the adequacy of the state law procedures. And Judge Mim correctly concluded, consistent with this court's precedent, that an action for a plevin or an action for conversion are sufficient to satisfy post-deprivation process. And the argument is made by the other side, well, you didn't tell us that we needed to go that route under state law, and the Supreme Court's decision in the City of West Covina versus Perkins case addresses that issue directly on point and establishes that if the procedures to follow under state law to regain property or to avoid a final deprivation are spelled out in state statutes and in case law, that's enough. The government does not have an additional duty to do lawyering for the complainant and give them additional notice of that. That's dispositive of this case. It's clear that Mr. Tucker...
Excuse me, just a minute. Mr. Clark, is he eating, Brian? Is Strozzi eating into the time of his co-counsel? Pardon? Separate, yeah, but...
Of my time?
Yes.
And then, okay, thank you. Thank you for that, for checking that. I've been in a situation on both sides of that where eating into time can be, create a problem, and I don't want to do that. So the City of West Covina case is dispositive here. The suggestion is made that somehow it doesn't apply. I think there's no way to get around it. This court's decision in the Gates versus City of Chicago case is inapposite because in that case there were factually distinguishing circumstances, which is that the city gave misinformation to the person about how to try and get their property back and then didn't even comply with the information that they were giving. That's not this case. There was no misinformation given. There was no effort by Mr. Tucker to try and regain possession of the property. He waited until the expiration of the statute of limitation to bring a Section 1983 civil rights action. He didn't really do anything to try and get the property back within the time that was available for him to do so. And I think that satisfactorily disposes of the procedural due process issue. I would want to say that there are arguments that are made in the reply brief for the first time that I haven't addressed unless the court has any concern about them. I would not address them. I consider them to have been forfeited. They weren't raised below. They weren't raised in the opening brief by Mr. Tucker. And as a procedural matter, I'd like to just clarify one thing. As a frequent practitioner in this court, the claim is made that I have improperly in my brief referred to the local rule 56.1 statements of uncontested facts, and that's an improper briefing practice. And what I want to say is that when people do that and are simply using that as a proxy or cipher to refer to materials in the record themselves without citing those record materials, that is improper. Here I have cited to those statements only when there is a corresponding admission of the truth of the statement. And those are independently a valid basis for the court, the district court, to grant summary judgment. And this court's precedent likewise say, when there are admissions of those Rule 56 statements, that is also a proper basis to affirm summary judgment. That is the only circumstance in which I have cited to those statements. I haven't tried to do it as a shorthand, lazy way of telling the court, you know, go fish, go find it yourself. To the contrary, when there are admissions, I rely on those. Otherwise, I'm not relying upon the Rule 56 statements.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you so much, Your Honors.
Mr. Elward.
Thank you.
Thank you and good morning. Brad Elward on behalf of the West Central Illinois Task Force. I'm just going to refer to them as the task force. I'd like to make a couple quick comments and then get to one of the questions that the courts had concerning the Maltby case. We obviously believe that the district court correctly found that the 11th Amendment bars Tucker's claims against the task force in this case.
Do we even need to reach this question if you prevail on the other, you know, the probable cause and so forth?
No, Your Honor, you do not. If you adopt all the arguments that my co-defendant has raised and affirm, no, you do not.
What about this Floyd versus Thompson case that talks about our 11th Amendment, our duty to reach the jurisdictional issue of the 11th Amendment.
The Floyd case doesn't ring a bell. I apologize.
Out of our circuit, 2000.
That doesn't ring a bell. I apologize. I'd be happy to submit a supplemental.
I'm probably not doing it justice. Is that our court should go ahead and look at 11th Amendment issues, even if the defendant claiming 11th Amendment immunity would win on the merits.
I understand that. Obviously, we would like you to. The task force, one of the reasons that they've tried to take a somewhat of an aggressive position with this is that they would like a ruling that addresses this for future cases. I think possibly you don't have to reach that issue, but we would certainly welcome it from the court. We think it's an important issue. And we would summarize it essentially as this. We think that the suit is barred against the tax force because it's essentially an arm of the Illinois State Police. We cited some cases, and we realize that the cases that we found are district court cases, and they don't have a lot of explanation. But it seems to be well established that the Illinois State Police, as an entity, is entitled to 11th Amendment protections. The task force in this case, per the agreement, the interagency agreement, operates as an arm of the Illinois State Police. Therefore, we make the argument that it should be entitled to the same protections as the Illinois State Police. Now, when I read over Tucker's brief, one of the things that they seem to be arguing is that essentially we're a local public entity, and they keep pointing to Section 1-206, and we cited that in our brief for the court to look at, but you'll notice there are three sentences in that paragraph. The first sentence says a local public entity includes certain entities. Then the second one defines additional ones, which includes it includes intergovernmental agencies. But the important part is the third sentence, and the third sentence specifically says that a local public entity does not include the state or any office, officer, department, division, bureau, board, commission, university, or similar agency of the state. We think that that sentence, when read with the rest of the language in that particular section of 206, gives the authority, it gives the basis for why you can treat the task force on the same basis as the Illinois State Police and why the task force is not a local public entity. Now, that kind of ties into the question that the court had posed concerning the Maltby case.
And I'm curious, the Maltby case is not discussed in your brief at all.
I thought we referenced it, Your Honor. I will double check, but you're correct, it was not referenced below. You're correct, we did not reference that, and the reason that we did not is we felt that it was not controlling on the case. And I'll say this, when we look at Maltby was a case from 1994, and the task force in that case had a jury verdict entered in favor of it, and in the process of defending that on appeal, an issue was raised to this court about whether or not there was 11th Amendment protections. And the court, in a footnote, addressed that and said, well, this claim was raised for the first time on appeal. We're really not going to consider it. But then it goes on to say, to talk about the interplay between 206. And I don't think we could say that the Maltby case is controlling because of the language that I just pointed out to the court. I don't believe from the footnote in Maltby that the court really considered the third sentence.
But Judge Mim distinguished Maltby.
He did. He did in his order.
But you don't rely on his distinction of it?
Well, my opponent didn't cite it in his brief, and so we didn't address it. We felt it wasn't a controlling case, so we didn't reference it either. But I would say before this court, I think that our reading of 206, using that third sentence to create an exclusion for the state, and as we said, similar agencies of the state, gives us the foundation to say that this task force, based on the wording of this task force agreement, is an arm of the state, and that the I see I'm out of time, if I may finish my sentence, and that the task force in here is entitled to 11th Amendment protections.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Elward.
Thank you.
Mr. Stiegel, do you have anything else? All right.
I will have to do a supplemental on the Maltby case. I'm sorry.
Well, it's a little late.
Yeah, I mean,
the district judge.
Yeah,
it's
you
been discussed extensively and not mentioned at all in your brief.
Yeah, I apologize. I went back through there, and I can't find the summary judgment order in my materials there. As the Maltby, I tried to get online. I'm sorry. I just,
you asked me a direct question, and that's the first time this happened, and I'm telling you, sorry.
It's a good thing to read carefully what the district judge writes and what the district judge relies on.
Yes, and I'm aware of that. I apologize for being remiss on that. The problem I come back to is, and there was a case, Johnson versus City of Evanston, in this court, where merely because the Fourth Amendment allows you to seize property, doesn't mean that you get to determine ownership. And Judge Easterbrook said that it may not be 48 hours like the hearing you're required for detention of a person, but you have to provide process afterwards. And then I had those other cases in the Tenth Circuit. Is the what I'm hearing here stands, it eliminates the procedural due process that existed for a century. Is that the notice is that not that it's seized, that you have a right to a here's your opportunity for a hearing. And the state has to provide that for you when they take the property. And in this case, what did Williams do? He made his own decision on ownership from an entity that didn't claim ownership. That's the most fascinating thing about this is ICMC, she doesn't know. She frankly said she didn't know. He called her, and that's what the record showed. And she says, we don't know if it was sold or stolen. We don't have a bill of sale. They never claimed ownership. So, I mean, if you get to a hearing, how in the world can you survive that? What right does he have to conclude?
So let's say a law enforcement officer chases down an alleged shoplifter, grabs the young guy with some candy or something like that. Does he have to send a notice to that guy that?
No. Well, he
regarding the candy, because he's not sure who owns it, right?
Well, I think it's clear there who owns it, and that's part of that does get resolved there. But that's not what happened here. We're talking it was purchased like 7 years ago. And, I mean, a bona fide purchase, and the adverse possession rules come in and everything else is you're not required to have certificates of title. And we have a police officer saying, oh, well, it's stolen, and you don't own it. Well, okay, who does own it? Well, ICMC. Well, we never claimed we owned it. Thanks for sending it to us. I mean, that's why we have hearings. And the primary obligation of all those Fuenes versus Seven, as I said, well, yeah, she knew her refrigerator, but it said you got to tell her when and where. And I think Wes Covina, the notice given in that case, is exactly what should have been done here. You know, this has been taken. Go to the judge, and you can determine what happens to your property. And the fascinating thing here to me is that he gave the property to someone who didn't claim ownership. And somehow that's right. As to the sanctions and side issue, way too much time has been spent on that. I am surprised to hear my colleague and an appellate lawyer is. One of the reasons Judge Mim did this is we had a 10-day period to get the pretrial order. And I'm getting sandbagged. I'm working hours on that pretrial order. All the man has to do is call me, and I assure you that is the standard of practice, to email or call and say, hey, I think I need to file a motion for leave to file summary judgment. My position had been take it to pretrial order. Well, let's stop and you file it, and let's ask Judge Mim. But that's what offended Judge Mim. That's what offended me, is that, you know, I've got a short pretrial I'm getting on it. One of his assistants is working with me, and I'm spending all my time on that, and I'm up late at night when I'm out of town responding to this motion for leave to file on something that's already been ruled on, and it turns out to be dispositive. Now, you can affirm on any grounds, Judge Mim, yeah, he didn't cross his T's right on the inherent power, but Rule 16 gives him the authority, Rule 26 does, and it says basically, you just didn't follow the standards of practice. All you had to do is let your adversary know. And then it was prolonged, and I never could get agreement on the amount. And we went into, I spent more time than it was worth trying to get agreement on the amount.
Thank you. All right. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the case under advisement. And we're